Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Who was Artemus Ogletree? Why did he give the name of Ronald T. Owen when checking into his final stay at a Kansas City hotel? So many questions surround this nearly 100-year-old unsolved mystery, and by the decade leave more questions than answers. Today on The Dark Side of Wikipedia, the mysterious death of Artemus Ogletree.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
On January 5th, 1935, a man who had given his name as Ronald T. Owen, later identified as Artemus Ogletree, died at a hospital in Kansas City, Missouri, in the United States, of beating and stabbing injuries. His death was preceded by a two-day stay in room 1046 at the President Hotel in Kansas City's Power and Light District, marked by communication with someone named Don, and unusual behavior and incidents noted by the hotel staff before he was found wounded in his room the morning of his death. When no next of kin could be located, leading to suspicions that his name was an alias, his body was stored in a local funeral parlor for almost 2 months. A planned burial in the city's Potter's Field was averted when an anonymous donor provided funds for a funeral and a floral arrangement signed Louise. The man's true identity remained unknown for a year and a half until Ruby Ogletree, an Alabama woman who had seen a photo of a distinctive scar on his head in the news, identified him as her son, Artemus. She said he had left Birmingham in 1934 at age 17 to hitchhike to California. Later, she received two letters purportedly from him, some as far away as Egypt. In August 1935, a caller claiming to be from Memphis, Tennessee, told her that Artemus was in Cairo. The letters had also been sent after Artemus' death. Records kept by shipping companies found no records that Ogletree had gone to Egypt. No other suspect has ever been identified. The letters later were used to link the killing to a 1937 murder in New York, but no charges were filed against the man arrested in that case, one of whose aliases had been Donald Kelso. The FBI later investigated, but was unable to produce any new leads. In 2012, a historian at the Kansas City Public Library wrote two posts on the library's blog about the case. At the end of the last one, he revealed that in 2003 or 04, he had taken a call from someone out of state related to the case. The caller said that they had been helping to inventory the belongings of a recently deceased elderly person when they found a box with newspaper clippings about Ogletree and an item mentioned repeatedly in the stories, but they refused to say what the item was. The Kansas City police continue to investigate to this day. So here we are, the dark side of Wikipedia, the murder of Artemus Ogletree today. Tony and Sean joining you. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download the program. This is really, it's somewhat of a cold case that is about 85 years old, if my math is correct, right around there. Is that about accurate? 1935-ish?
85, yeah, carry the one. Uh-huh.
There you go. Well, this is airing in 2021, so actually 84 years. 86, yes. So that's the direction we go with math. It's kind of amazing that anyone would even be around up into the year 2012 to even give a shit enough to reach out with that information. It makes you really wonder how much shit sits in people's attics in boxes of kind of dark things from the past that have happened or they were involved with or knew about that simply gets left to relatives as they're going through and cleaning things out. And they have to decipher whether there's any value to this item, period, in terms of monetary. And then number two, information. Because just newspaper clippings and some items, unless you take the time to look at it, you go, oh, yeah, they stored a bunch of random stuff and boom, in the dumpster it goes.
A lot, to answer your question, a lot. You just have an aunt or an uncle or a grandma or a grandpa where they're attic alone, you help them move.
Yeah.
You think to yourself, holy hell. And then factor that across millions of places. And it's maddening the amount of, as a officer or somebody part of a judicial system, I don't think I'd be able to sleep at night with the amount of cold cases that I knew that were out there that I would want to assist with. I would not be good in that role.
And how many investigators, you know, have been on this case over the course of 86 years, you know, where it's like, oh, congratulations, welcome to the force. You get the Artemis case. Oh, what's going on with that? Well, in the last 86 years, here's what we got. Somebody at some point you hope would be able to put this to bed, but as every year goes by, you know, people die or are already dead, and pieces of evidence that may answer the question, you know, get tossed away because people don't even know what they're looking at.
It's got to be maddening for somebody to continue on. And it's interesting, somebody in the latest century, that it had that momentum to continue on. And hopefully, what, 35 to 2003, so that's carry the one, there'll be somebody charged in this case in about 2080.
And they'll be nearly 150 years old or so.
And they'll probably still be alive. They'll still be running 5Ks with medical
sure.
progression and such. Absolutely. And then they'll go to jail.
Why not? They'll be like it'll be like Forever Young, the movie with Mel Gibson. We found him. He's in that cryovac container in that warehouse down on 15th Street.
Spoiler alert, the actual person that killed the guy, Mel Gibson's great-grandfather.
Wow, what a 360 right there that we didn't know we were going to run into. Mel Gibson's grandfather turned out to be the killer. No. Let's continue on with the story of Artemis Ogletree here on the dark side of Wikipedia. Artemis Ogletree was born in Florida in 1915 as one of three children. During his childhood, an accident with some hot grease left a sizable scar on his head above his ear, which remained hairless afterwards. In 1934, he left his family by then living in Birmingham, Alabama, to hitchhike to California. He kept them updated on his progress by mail. They wired him money. Early in the afternoon of January 2nd, 1935, Ogletree walked into the hotel president in the Power and Light District of Kansas City, Missouri, and asked for an interior room several floors up, giving his name as Ronald T. Owen with a Los Angeles address. Staff remembered him as dressed well and wearing a dark overcoat. He brought no bags with him. Ogletree paid for one night. Staff noted that in addition to the visible scar on his temple, he had a cauliflower ear and concluded that he was probably a boxer, a professional wrestler. They believed him to be in his early 20s. Randolph Probst, a bellhop, accompanied Ogletree up in the elevator to the 10th floor. On the way, Ogletree told him that he had spent the previous night at the nearby Mullenbach Hotel, but found the $5 nightly rate to be too high, which would be equivalent to $100 today. Probst opened room 1046, which per the guest request was on the inside overlooking the hotel's courtyard rather than the street outside. He watched as Ogletree took a hairbrush, comb, and toothpaste from his overcoat pocket and the extent of his unpacking. After Ogletree put those items above the sink, he and Probst left the room. The bellboy returned to Lockett and gave Ogletree the key. After returning to the lobby, he saw Ogletree leave the hotel. A short time afterward, Mary Soptic, one of the hotel maids, returned from the day off to work the afternoon shift. She went to the room 1046 and was surprised to find Ogletree there, since the previous night a woman had been in the room. She apologized, but he said she could go ahead and clean the room. When she did, she noticed that he had the shades drawn and left only one dim lamp on. This would remain the case when she encountered Ogletree in the room on other occasions during his stay. He was either worried about something or afraid. In addition to his preference for low light, she told police later. After she had been cleaning for a few minutes, Ogletree put his overcoat on and brushed his hair. He then left, but asked her to leave the room unlocked as he was expecting some friends in a few minutes. Soptic did as he was asked. At 4 p.m., she returned to the room with freshly laundered towels. Inside the room was dark, and she saw Ogletree lying on the bed, fully dressed. Visible in the light from the hallway was a note on his bedside table that read, "Don, I will be back in 15 minutes. Wait." January 3rd, the next morning, Soptic returned to room 1046 around 10:30. The door was locked, which led her to assume that Ogletree was out, since it could only be locked from the outside, but when she opened it with her own key, Ogletree was present, sitting in the dark, just where he had been the previous afternoon. The phone rang and he answered it. "No, Don, I don't want to eat. I'm not hungry. I just had breakfast. No, I am not hungry," he said. Still holding the phone, Ogletree asked Soptic about her job as she cleaned. He wanted to know if she was responsible for the entire floor and if the president was residential. He repeated his complaint about the Mullenbach's exorbitant rates, after which she finished cleaning and left. Again at 4 p.m., Soptic returned with fresh towels. Inside room 1046, she could hear two men talking, so she knocked. The voice she described as loud and deep, probably not Ogletree's, asked who it was. She responded that she had brought fresh towels, to which the voice said, "We don't need any." It Soptic knew there were no towels in the room, as she had taken them herself in the morning. 2 hours later, Gene Owen of Lee's Summit near Kansas City checked into the president after having shopped in the city for a few hours. Feeling sick, she decided not to drive back home that night. She was given room 1048. Her boyfriend, who worked in a flower shop in the city, came to visit her there at 9:20 p.m. and stayed for 2 hours. Later that night, she told police she heard men and women talking loudly and profanely all over the floor. Owen was not the only person to note unusual late-night activity on the president's 10th floor. Elevator operator Charles Botchler, who began his shift at midnight, reported later that he was fairly busy until 1:30 a.m. After that time, most of the hotel quieted down for the night, except for a loud party in room 1055. Botchler recalled one visitor in particular, a woman he had seen in the hotel visiting male guests in their rooms on other occasions and thus believed to be a prostitute. In conclusion, shared by other hotel staff who were familiar with her, she came in first, sometimes during his first 3 hours. He took her to the 10th floor, where she asked about room 1026. 5 minutes later, the elevator was summoned there again, and it turned out to be the same woman who expressed puzzlement that her client was not in room 1046, since she said he had called her, and on previous visits with him, he had always been present. She wondered if, in fact, he was in room 1024, since she could see through the room's transom window that the light was on in there. She remained on the floor after the conversation. A half hour later, Botchler got another signal to take the elevator back to the 10th floor. The woman was waiting again, and he took her down to the lobby. An hour later, he took her and a different man to the 9th floor. And at 4:15 a.m., a call from that floor turned out to be the woman. He took her to the lobby, and she left the hotel for the night. Another call to the 9th floor 15 minutes later turned out to be the man who had come up with her. He told Botchler he could not sleep and was going out for a walk. When these activities are related to the Ogletree case, has not been established. He may not have been at the hotel earlier that night. At 11 p.m., Robert Lane, a city worker driving on the 13th Street near Lydia Avenue, saw a man dressed in only an undershirt, pants, and shoes run into his path and flag him down. When Lane stopped, the man apologized, saying that he had taken Lane's car for a taxi. The man asked Lane if he could take him to somewhere he might be able to get a taxi. Lane agreed and let the man in. "You look as if you've been in it bad," he observed. The man swore he would kill someone else tomorrow, presumably in relation for whatever had been done to him. In the mirror, Lane saw a deep scratch on the man's arm. He also noticed that he was cupping his arm, possibly to catch blood from a more severe wound. At the nearby intersection of 12th Street and Troost Avenue, where taxi drivers often waited for fares during the overnight hours, Lane stopped and let the man out. The man thanked him, got out, and honked the horn for a taxi parked nearby, drawing the driver from a nearby restaurant, after which Lane drove away. After Ogletree's death, Lane went to view the body. He saw the same scratch on the arm and went to the police, telling them he believed Ogletree had been the man that he had picked up. What is amazing to me is the detailed amount of accounts that are out there in relation to this case. And I'm guessing they were given very early on when people were trying to figure all of this out. But trying to piece together what happened in that room with that man on what seems to be one crazy, wild, drunken night of insanity in that hotel 86 years later, I don't know how the hell you do it.
You know, I really don't think there is a way to. And I think that's where conjecture comes in. I think that's where maybe there are facts, in air quotes,
yeah,
a few, but then you almost have to create the narrative. You have to assume and put the witness accounts together. I just wanted to go up to that room and if the walls could talk.
I still have unsolved mysteries of nights that I've had back when we had even gone to Las Vegas together and consumed far too much. And the next day, you're like, where did we go? What happened? And I think there's still, blank spots there. I don't know how. And that was, 10 some years ago. But 86 years ago, some things you just got to write off and go, there's no way you're ever going to know what the fuck happened.
I think there's a point you get to in your life when you wake up and you don't even remember what you had for breakfast.
Yeah.
Let alone 86 years ago. And what's interesting, which I know this is a little bit off course, but if you come to a point in your life where you literally don't remember what you had for lunch or breakfast, but you can remember what baseball hat you were wearing when you were 11 on your family trip to the Dells. I absolutely used Aquafresh from 9 years old to 11 years old for toothpaste.
Yeah.
But I don't know what I had for lunch 27 minutes ago.
That's kind of me.
Yeah. And you will literally fight tooth and nail to your parent or your sibling or, your best friend. No. It was this mix that we were listening to on the road trip to Cleveland. I remember. And we drove your Toyota Camry and it was light blue. And you're like, oh, what did you, where did you have to go again today? The list you made? I completely forgot. I couldn't remember.
No idea what we were talking about 20 minutes ago. But I can tell you for sure I was wearing blue sunglasses on the front, yellow on the side, and they had the word Milwaukee Brewers and Sure Make Sausages on the other side for a majority of my childhood as the sunglasses that I would get. And I got it at a Milwaukee Brewers opener game in like 90, probably like 91 or so. And I had my first Clearly Canadian there as well. I can recite all of these amazing little pointless things, but I couldn't tell you what I went to the store for once I finally get to the store today.
I think what's comforting and what brings it back to make us all feel good and the few folks that are maybe feeling similarly is those memories, whether they happened this morning or 10 years ago, they bring joy. They bring something that encapsulated the brain, hopefully listening to us every time you. But, having a bowl of oatmeal and coffee, not really that memorable this morning.
Now, I wonder if that's something that goes on right now psychologically just with people, if that's something that can be studied and looked at, where when you're in a very, trying time, a very taxing time mentally, if the brain just naturally almost pulls up happier, warmer memories as a way of survival and staying sane, and then just discounts other things that when you weren't so taxed would be easy to remember. You could easily say, yeah, it was the Special K with the berries and it was the strawberries I had this morning. It wasn't the blueberry one. And in normal days, 2018, you could probably tell that pretty easily. Today, no, but I can tell you it was a peach clearly Canadian I had at County Stadium in Milwaukee in 90. I think our brains do that sometimes where it's like, nope, we're really running low on the positive area, so we better just pull any random shit that made them feel good at some point in life and just start pumping that out since there ain't much good coming in right now.
That, I would like that post if I could, that audio message. Yes, I would retweet that.
Yeah, someone can concisely say that. I think that that's fairly accurate. Let's continue in here with the story of Artemis Ogletree here on the dark side of Wikipedia. January 4th at 7 a.m., a new switchboard operator, Della Ferguson, came on shift. She was preparing to make a request wake-up call to room 1046 when she noticed a light indicating that the phone was off the hook. Probst, who had led Ogletree there 2 days earlier, was on shift again and drew the assignment. The door to room 1046 was locked with the Do Not Disturb sign hanging from the doorknob. After several loud knocks, a voice from inside told him to enter. However, he could not as the door had been locked. The same voice told him after another knock to turn the lights, but he still could not enter. Finally, Probst just shouted through the door to hang up the phone and left. Probst told Ferguson that the guest in room 1046 is probably drunk and she should wait another hour. At 8:30 a.m., the phone had still not been hung up. Another bellboy, Harold Pike, was sent to the 10th floor. The Do Not Disturb sign was still on the door and it was still locked, but Pike had a key and let himself in. Inside, he found Ogletree in the dark, lying on the bed naked, apparently drunk. The light from the hallway showed some dark spots on the bedding, but rather than turn on the room light, Pike went to the telephone stand where he saw the phone had been knocked to the floor. He put it back on the stand, replacing the handset. Shortly after 10:30 a.m., another operator reported that the phone in room 1046 was once again off the hook. Again, Probst was sent to the room to see what was going on. The Do Not Disturb sign remained on the knob. This time he had a key, and after his knocks drew no response, he opened the door and found Ogletree on his knees and elbows 2 feet away, his head bloodied. Probst turned the light on, put the phone back on the hook, and then noticed blood on the walls of both the main room and bathroom, as well as on the bed itself. Probst went downstairs immediately for help. He returned with his assistant manager, but when they did, they could only open the door 6 inches, as Ogletree had interimly fallen on the door in front of the door on the floor. Eventually, Ogletree got up and went to two hotel employees who were able to enter the room. He went and sat on the edge of the bathtub. The assistant manager called the police. They were joined by Dr. Harold Flanders of Kansas City General Hospital. Ogletree had been bound with cord around his neck, wrists, and ankles. His neck had further bruising, suggesting someone had been attempting to strangle him. He had been stabbed more than once in the chest above the heart. One of these wounds had punctured his lung. Blows to his head had left him with a skull fracture on the right side. In addition to blood, Probst had seen, there was some additional splatter on the ceiling. Dr. Flanders cut the cords from Ogletree's wrist and asked him who had done this to him. Nobody, Ogletree answered. Asked then what had caused the injuries, he said he had fallen and hit his head on the bathtub. The doctor asked if he had been trying to kill himself. After saying no, Ogletree lost consciousness and was taken to the hospital. He was completely comatose by the time he arrived and died shortly after midnight on January 5th. The Kansas City Police Department began investigating immediately by interviewing John Owen, whose identical last name and proximity to the dead man overnight struck them as interesting. They detained her while she told them what she had heard the night before. After her boyfriend came to the police station and corroborated her account, she was released and returned to Lee's Summit. Doctors performed an autopsy on Ogletree and determined he had died from his wounds. Dr. Flanders had examined not just the body but the blood stains in the room, since much of it had dried by the time he had arrived. He estimated the wounds had been inflicted between 4 and 5 a.m. that day, consistent with what Pike had seen and before Probst's first visit. Detective searching room 1046 took note as much of what they did not find as what they did. Consistent with what Probst had observed, there were no clothes in the closets or drawers. The only evidence of anything other than what Ogletree had been wearing was the tag of a necktie, indicating it had been made by a New Jersey company. Also missing from the room were the soap, shampoo, and towels provided by the hotel to every room. There were no knives, which led to the dismissal of suicide as a cause of Ogletree's death, since the stab wounds in his chest could not be accounted for. The cords tying him up also suggested the involvement of others. One of the room's two glasses was found in the sink, missing a piece. The other was on the shelf. Detective found some other items that might have been evidence. A hairpin, safety pin, unsmoked cigarette, and a full bottle of diluted sulfuric acid. Four fingerprints, small enough that detectives believe they had been a woman's, were found on the room's phone. They could not be matched to Ogletree or to any of the hotel employees who had been known to have entered the room. The police sought help through the press. Both of the city's evening newspapers carried the story on their front pages the next day. "There's no doubt someone else is mixed up in this," Detective Johnson told reporters, confirming that the case was considered a homicide. It soon became apparent that Ronald T. Owen was, in all likelihood, an alias. Officers in Kansas City contacted the Los Angeles Police Department to notify next of kin, but were informed that they could find no record that anyone under that name was living in the California city at the time. The dead man's fingerprints were sent to what was at the time the Justice Department's Bureau of Investigation to find a possible match in their collection. A woman called the hotel president that night to ask what Ronald T. Owen looked like. She told the desk that he lived in Clinton, 50 miles southeast of Kansas City. On January 6th, the Sunday newspapers reported that a man in room 1046 had died under an assumed name, and tips began coming in. Members of the public went to the local funeral home where he had been laid out, leading Lane to tell police of his encounter with the man. After interviewing Lane, Johnson was not as certain as Lane was that the man that had been Ogletree, since none of the hotel staff had reported seeing him leave and returning the night of January 3rd to 4th. Police were able to establish one sighting of Ogletree outside the hotel, a report that had been seen with two women at several liquor places on the 12th Street. Wire services began picking up the story, and it ran in newspapers and on radio around the country with requests to send photographs to Kansas City. More leads on the man's identity came in as a result, and the KCPD had to devote considerable time to corresponding with police all over the country via mail and telegram to follow up on leads. Eventually, they were able to eliminate many. In Kansas City, an early lead provided proof false when a bloody towel found at a hotel turned out to have been used to clean up room 1046 after the police had left. Officers recalled Probst's account that on his way there, after he checked in, the man had said that he had left the nearby Mullenbach Hotel after one night due to their high rates and checked with the hotel staff. No Ronald T. Owen had checked in there. But staff remembered and recalled a man of Ogletree's appearance checking in under the name Eugene K. Scott, also giving Los Angeles as his address and requesting a room on the interior of the building. Again, after investigating, the LAPD reported that there was no one by that name in their city. The mystery seemed solved when a man identified the body as his cousin, but then when the man's sister came to view the body, she confirmed that the cousin had in fact died 5 years earlier. The resemblance between the two had been very strong. A week into the investigation, Tony Bernardi, a wrestling promoter from Little Rock, Arkansas, said after viewing the body that the man, identifying himself as Cecil Werner, had approached him around the beginning of December of 1934 about wrestling some matches. Bernardi had referred him to another promoter in Omaha, Nebraska, but that promoter did not recognize Ogletree. Within a few days, two new homicides in the city drew detectives' attention away from the case, even as more were assigned to the homicide squad. Leads were still followed, but less vigorously than they had been in the week after the case, and none of them yielded any significant information. Newspaper coverage likewise dwindled. So it just keeps getting more and more interesting and almost alluding to questions as to whether or not the man that was dead in that room that they found was even the same man that checked in that night, that identified himself under an alias but turned out to be Ogletree. Was there another person here that ended up being murdered and no one knew who this guy was? I mean, it's very, very interesting.
My eyes went crossed about 17 times trying to follow along to that. Second you actually get somewhere, then you come to find out, wait, is it this person or it's not that person? It's a modern day game of Clue.
It is.
Can you imagine if media back then was like it is now, as far as this just in, new details on blah, 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 Oglesby? I mean, wait, done. I mean, in the whole, if it bleeds, it leads, got to be first.
Yeah.
Right. It would cause this to go in so many ways. People getting arrested that had nothing to do with anything. I guess that's the only silver lining in this, that there wasn't enough outlets to publicize. I know print and newspaper, et cetera, but wow, there's a lot of confusing information of where this is going.
I know. It just keeps going darker and darker and stranger and stranger. I mean, I'm fascinated by these cases, but there are so many that are just like, what the hell did I just watch? There was a case we just talked about, not you and me, but me and Carol on a previous episode. In fact, right before this one, it was in reference to the Netflix series Evil Genius, which if you watch it, you're going to be just as befuddled. It's a much more current day case, but just completely befuddling because it's like, wait a second, if this piece moves over here, it affects nothing. Nothing makes sense. And by the time you're all is said and done, all the key players are dead. And you're trying to put these pieces together. And I think sometimes in these cases, and as I said on that episode the other day, I think sometimes it looks so crazily confusing and that there's so many pieces at play. But almost sometimes we need to take a step back and look at things. Almost like when you ask a child a question, they will sometimes give you a much simpler answer that makes much more sense than how an adult brain will look and overanalyze things sometimes. I remember as a child being at a school rally or whatever, everybody's in the gym. And there was one of the teachers was talking and giving a speech, and just an example of how brains change in the way of thinking. They asked the eighth graders the question, okay, if a pea, a pea, like the vegetable, rolls off of a roof and into a puddle on the ground outside of that house, what is the pea? And everyone is like, what do you mean, what is the pea? Like, did it, we're all trying to think, did it turn into something? And it's like, well, it turned, maybe it grew into a pea stalk, a pea plant or whatnot. Nope, that's not the answer, because we're not talking in the future. No one said the future. No one said this or that, but we assign so many different variables that aren't there, but we assume that they must be there. And then they went and asked the kindergartners the exact same question. And all the kindergartners got their answer correct immediately. What is the pea? It's wet. It fell off. It's in a puddle. It is now wet. And that's the answer to the question. I think sometimes when we're in cases like this that appear to be so complicated, sometimes, yes, they are very deep and there's weird things that people are doing that no one could predict or guess. But sometimes it may just be as simple as this guy wronged somebody. He was trying to hide out. They found him. They killed him. They disappeared, and that's it. And there's not other people involved. There's not this or that. It's just much more simple than meets the eye. But the evidence makes you think there's far more involved. And I wonder if that's part of what's happening here in this story.
I would agree. But quite honestly, trying to make sense of something that just can't make sense. Often the truth is so boring, We get so excited, and the juicy gossip and details. You know, everybody has an office space, or back when they actually went to work in a physical structure, they would hear a story of Sherry's cousin. And then by the 14th time somebody tells a story, then she killed him. What? She had a root canal. That's why she wasn't at work the last week, because it got infected. So no, she's not incarcerated. She didn't kill anyone. The truth is boring. And I'll tell you the best piece of advice I got from my mother: when a person tells you a story at work, because clearly you can choose or not if you want to spread gossip, that is 100% on you. But sometimes you can't control if somebody tells you a story.
Sure.
But she said, you can control how you react.
Oh,
and
completely.
She said, regardless of what you're told, just say, uh-huh, really, really. So that, and no matter how they spin it, when they talk to Sheila in accounting and they're like, yeah, and I told Tony the story. Well, what did Tony say? He said, really? And then he said, really? Oh, really? There is no way they can even salivate you into looking like a bad person.
Yeah.
And it's good to use. Should we ever go back to work, or if some of us are back in the workplace, it will alleviate any backstabbing that you didn't intentionally do, because you didn't spread any more gossip.
Sure. I mean, controlling reactions is something that I'm a huge proponent of. I don't follow it all the time, especially right now. I'm aggravated to death. We were talking off the air about people not wearing masks and having people that I know who have died because of exposure to the coronavirus and such. So it's a hot topic, and it really, it aggravates the shit out of me as we're recording this in October of 2020 when I see that. But it is my reaction that is creating the aggravation. I can't change these people. I can't change someone who just doesn't connect the dots. I'm not going to connect the dots for them, no matter how much I'd like to, in a very firm asshole way or in a very kind, warm, loving way. Neither way will work. But I can control my reaction. And that's a big thing in anything you're dealing with, especially right now, whether it's aggravation like I have about the mask thing and people not wearing them, or just, you know, anything, your kids at home, of, you know, what's going on with your workplace or a boss, or trying to manage all of this shit. We do have far more control over our reactions than we are oftentimes aware of. And so many times we let those reactions take us over. And now more than ever, even though it is so difficult and you can say it's impossible, it's not. It really is not. And for the best, that's a lesson that I think we can only benefit from the more we can try and embrace that concept and live by it. It's not easy, but it is, in fact, possible for most people. There are cases, obviously, if we're going to go down the roads, you know, of, you know, they're just not capable for whatever mental reason that may be. But for a lot of us, the capability is there if we embrace it. Let's continue on with the story here and see how this ends for Artemis Ogletree here on the Dark Side of Wikipedia. The case returned to the newspapers on March 3rd when the funeral home where the body had been kept announced it would be burying the man in the city's Potter's Field the next day. That day, the funeral home received a call from a man who asked that the funeral be delayed so they could send the funeral home the money for a grave and service at Memorial Park Cemetery in Kansas City, Kansas. So the caller said the dead man would be near his sister. The funeral director warned the caller he would have to tell the police about the call. The caller said he knew, and it did not bother him. The caller was slightly more forthcoming when the funeral director asked why Ogletree had been killed. According to the caller, Ogletree had had an affair with one woman while engaged to marry another. The caller and the two women had apparently arranged the encounter with him at the president in order to exact revenge. Cheaters usually get what's coming to them, the caller said, and hung up. The service was postponed per the anonymous caller's request. On March 23rd, the funeral home received a delivery envelope, the address carefully lettered using a ruler, with $25. $500 in current dollars wrapped in its newspaper was enough to cover the expenses. The sender was unknown. Two additional envelopes with $5 each were sent to the local florist for an arrangement of 13 American Beauty roses to go with the grave. After a similar call was made to them, both phone calls turned out to have been made from payphones, including with this payment was a card with disguised handwriting reading, "Love Forever, Louise." The funeral was held shortly afterwards. Besides the officiating minister, the only attendees were police detectives, some of whom served as pallbearers. Other detectives posing as gravediggers staked out the grave for the next several days, but no one came to visit. Several days after the funeral, a woman called the Kansas City Journal-Post newsroom to inform them that their earlier story that the dead man from room 1046 would be buried in a pauper's grave was incorrect, that he had in fact been given a formal funeral. She said the funeral home and flower shop could verify this. Asked to identify herself, she said, "Never mind, I know what I'm talking about." Pressed for what that was, she responded, "He got into a jam," and ended the conversation. Images of the dead man continued to be circulated nationwide in the hopes of identifying him. One of these finally did when a friend of Ruby Ogletree in Birmingham, Alabama, showed her an issue of the American Weekly, a Sunday newspaper supplement published by the Hearst Corporation, with an article about the case. The unidentified man looked a great deal like her son, Artemis, whom the family had not seen since he left to hitchhike to California in 1934, although he had kept correspondence with them. Ruby contacted the KCPD and was able to provide enough information about the previous pseudonym corpse, including a description of his head scar, which she explained was a result of a childhood accident in which he got hot grease spilled there. In November, another issue of the supplement carried the story identifying the man as Artemis Ogletree and explaining how his identity had been determined. While that question had been answered, Ruby's account raised more questions. She'd received several letters purportedly from her son after he had been killed. The first, early in 1935, postmarked in Chicago, aroused her suspicion since it was typewritten, and Artemis, as far as she knew, did not know how to type. It was also written in highly colloquial style, which with much slang that was not consistent with the previous letters. In May of 1935, another letter purportedly from Artemis said that he was going to Europe. It was followed by a special delivery letter saying that his ship was sailing that day. Both missives were sent from New York. 3 months later, in August, Ruby received a telephone call from Memphis, Tennessee. A man on the other end of the line told her that Artemis had saved his life in a fight. Artemis himself could not call because he was now living in Cairo, the capital of Egypt, where he had married a wealthy woman and was well. He was unable to write, the caller said, because he had lost one of his thumbs in the fight where he had saved the caller. Ruby talked to the man for half an hour. She recalled that he had talked wildly and irrationally, but seemed to have first-hand knowledge of Artemis. She gave the police the name and the man identified himself by, but it had never been made public. If Artemis had, at some point before his death, gone to Egypt or anywhere else overseas, he had not done so under his own name. No steamship company at the time had any record that he had traveled with them. The consular section of the U.S. Embassy in Cairo was unable to find any evidence he had been there. Later developments, information developed through the police's conversation with Ruby Ogletree helped them establish a third hotel in Kansas City, the St. Regis, where Artemis had stayed. There, he had roomed with another man. Whether that had been Don could not be established. In 1937, the New York City police arrested a man named Joseph Martin on a murder charge after he had killed a man he roomed with and put the body in the trunk to be shipped to Memphis. Among the several aliases he was found to have used was Donald Kelso. According to a story about the case in New York, the KCPD had matched samples of his handwriting to that of the letters written to Ruby Ogletree. No charges were filed against the man for the Ogletree case, and the KCPD kept the case open. The files show that different detectives reviewed the case every few years through the 1950s. Each time they noted that they would keep the case open and follow up, but no new evidence was uncovered. Gradually, the case went cold. In 2003 or 2004, John Horner, a local historian at the Kansas City Public Library, filed a call from someone out of state who said they had been helping to inventory the belongings of an elderly person who had recently died. Among them was a shoebox, which turned out to be filled with newspaper clippings related to the case, as well as, according to them, one item mentioned in the newspaper stories. The caller identified neither themselves nor the item. Horner did not make this public until the conclusion of the second of two posts he made in the library's blog, retelling the story in 2012. The absence of suspects has not prevented theories about the case from arising. The telephone calls alleging that Ogletree was killed in retaliation for his broken engagement have provided support for that theory. Organized crime has also been considered, since the name Don can also be a title for a mafia boss. Lastly, it has been suggested that Don, whoever he was, killed Ogletree for some personal reason, either with the help of the commercial woman Botchler saw in the hotel later that night, or by himself. So there you go. Still left with many, many questions. The fact that letters, though, continued to be sent to the mother all those years after his death and that he was in Cairo, Egypt, almost really, to me, points to him being murdered and someone trying to cover the traces so that a family doesn't, I guess, try to pursue or push an investigation into a death, because that could certainly, you know, lead to more chances of the murderer himself being caught.
So much happening, much like those Clue-like movies or pretty much anything Johnny Depp is in. About 45 minutes into the movie, I'm lost. I stretch my legs, go get some popcorn, go to the bathroom. I'm too literal of a person. I have my list and I put this down and this down and this down. This is clear as mud.
Yeah. It's like you can almost sometimes take Johnny Depp movies and intermix them halfway through. And it's like a choose your own adventure book. It's like, oh, it was Willy Wonka. And now it's Sleepy Hollow. And still the movie makes Johnny Depp sense.
Same thing.
Same movie. It's like suddenly we're a different time and place, characters and setting, but it's Johnny Depp, so it makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems that's kind of how this case feels.
This is a whodunit, and I thought by the end of this episode we would have known at least a pretty good presumption of whodunit. Nope, just as clueless as the beginning.
I think someone had done it. We don't know who done it, but I'm guessing it leads to Ogletree wronged someone, and the consequence of wronging that someone was his death. Now, was it the women? Was it the engagement thing? And then they plotted to have a hitman come and kill him? That seems a bit steep. I don't know. You know, for the time at least, but plausible. You know, or was it something, some sort of business dealing he was doing there in Kansas City, and the Kansas City mob, you know, they caught up to him at some point, and that's just, you know, that's why he was hiding out in the interior room of a hotel and going by pseudonyms. I don't know, but then why didn't he just leave the area too, if he's kind of a drifter? So many questions that unfortunately will likely never have an answer.
But not speechless often, but this would be a time baffling.
It is. It is one of those cases. That's going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia, the Room 1046 Mystery, the murder of Artemis Ogletree. If you like our program, be sure to press subscribe on every platform you listen to us on, and leave us a good review there over there on Apple iTunes. That greatly helps us in the rankings and lets other folks know we, in fact, exist. So thank you for that in advance. Until next time, for Sean and all of us at The Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.